from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Over 12 weeks, writer Nick Neely traversed 650 miles in California on foot. Walking from San Diego to San Francisco, Neely followed the route taken by the 1769 Portola expedition, learning about the Spanish explorers and native tribes who populated 18th century California and reflecting on their legacy. Coming up, Nick Neely joins us in studio to talk about his book, Alta California, and his journey. And we want to hear from you. What parts of California history are best learned in person? What parts of California have you visited that are emblematic of its history? Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're at KQED Forum, or email us at forum@kqed.org. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In 1769, Spanish explorer Gaspar de Portola trekked from what is now modern-day San Diego to San Francisco. And in 2016, writer Nick Neely followed in Portola's footsteps by completing the 650-mile hike himself on foot. Over 12 weeks, Neely followed the course of the Portola expedition, gaining a deeper understanding of California's fraught history and witnessing the state's beauty firsthand. Nick Neely joins us to share what he chronicles in his new book, Alta California, From San Diego to San Francisco, A Journey on Foot to Rediscover the Golden State. And welcome, Nick Neely.
Thanks so much for having me.
Glad to have you. And let's begin by saying that this is really a couple and a half centuries after that expedition. You did grow up in Portola Valley, but what inspired you to take that trip by foot, no less?
Yeah, growing up in Portola Valley, which is adjacent to Palo Alto, was part of it. I had always heard the Portola name, and I had thought, actually, that he had come over, and I knew the expedition had been the first Europeans to see the San Francisco Bay. I thought they had come over the crest of the Santa Cruz Mountains in my town. Learned later that wasn't true, that it was further north in Pacifica. And so, in part, the book was a chance to learn the history I really should have lived or learned more as a kid. And the project really unfolded for me. In my first book, Coast Range, I wrote an essay about the Madrone tree, which we have up and down the coast. It's a beautiful, sinuous tree with glossy leaves. And I learned in the writing of that essay that the Portola expedition had given name to that tree because it looked like a similar species, Madronio, that's found in Spain.
Well, they gave a lot of names.
Yeah,
Santa Cruz,
yeah,
Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I mean, just go on.
Yeah. Well,
and it's an extraordinary story in many ways because there is so much history here. There's also all the fauna and flora. In fact, some of the regions you went through mm-hmm. have more fauna and flora than any other region in California. And you had some great adventures, and you have some real anecdotal and saga-type stories to tell. But what I was struck by particularly was so much of the history. Remember, this is the first overland Spanish expedition. And so mm-hmm. in addition to establishing the missions, which, of course, I want to talk with you about, or laying groundwork mm-hmm. for the establishing of the missions, there was a lot else that came out of this historically. I mean, Camino Real.
Completely. This journey predates the missions. So they were looking, they were scouting for mission sites. They were looking for valleys that had good soil and plentiful water. And that's one of the main things that the main diarist of the expedition, Padre Juan Crespi, was tracking. So the route that I took at times did overlap with the El Camino Real. But at other times, it diverged from it significantly. They refined the ultimate locations for missions. So some of the terrain that I walked was pretty far from El Camino.
This was also supposed to be for Spanish galleons. I mean, they were scouting that
yeah.
as well as Russian trade, right?
Right. Well, they were in search of the port of Monterrey, which we now know as Monterrey. And this had been glowingly described, this port, by the Spanish explorer Sebastian Vizcaino in 1602. And so there was thought that this port could be a base for trade ships returning from the Philippines. And also the Spanish were concerned with alleged Russian fur traders trickling down the coast. They wanted to claim the territory first, and they also wanted to establish missions to convert the indigenous population.
I want to talk about the indigenous population. They were out to convert them, as you suggest, from being pagans and godless and all that. But let's talk first about the source. You went to the journals, particularly Crespi's journals.
Yeah, that's the main one I'm in conversation with in the book. And also, the three journals were kept on the expedition, another by Miguel Costanzo, who is the engineer.
Did you see the journals before you went on the trek or during it?
I did. I read them before, and actually my approach was to reread them each night for the next day's portion of the walk so that I'd have that entry fresh in mind and can look out for resonances and also make sure I was going the right direction.
And you mentioned Monterey. Monterey and Carmel actually became the headquarters for Alta California.
Yes, it did. They didn't quite, in 1769, they weren't sure they recognized Monterey Bay, which is why they kept going and ultimately became the first Europeans to see San Francisco Bay. So they returned to San Diego and then made a second trip back to Monterey, in which they established the Presidio there and the mission in Monterey, which moved to Carmel shortly thereafter.
Inspired at all by Cheryl Strayed?
That's a fraught question. That's a great book. I had always wanted to do a long hike like that on the Pacific Crest Trail for an environmental or natural history lover. That has great appeal, and so this is in some ways a response to that. I couldn't compete with that, I thought, and I wanted to do something that would take me through more varied terrain, through suburbs, cities, agricultural fields. I feel like all those places are neglected by natural history and environmental writers very often, and so.
Well, you're a naturalist writer and a poetic writer, and you don't have to be so humble about Cheryl Strayed. I mean, you write very well and you write poetically. I must say, though, when we talk about the indigenous people, this is a devastating story. I mean, in terms of what was done to them by the attempt to convert and by essentially what many people see as, if not a literal genocide, a cultural genocide, and all the disease it was brought to.
Yeah, it was. And it was, it was a sobering walk in that regard. Whenever I could, I stopped in at the missions that were within striking distance of my path and to see the history there, learn about the atrocity, what was displayed there and what I learned afterwards was really, really humbling and something that I hope comes through well in the book, that this first contact was sort of the beginning of the end and disease would take its toll immediately and the assimilation and what else happened at the missions was we can never truly rectify that.
Actually, in reading your book, I found myself thinking of a lot of writers, Thoreau for one, and Edward Abbey naturally, but also a writer named Leslie Marmon Silko, who is a Native American writer. Yeah. You're familiar with her,
I am, yeah.
Because she writes about the disjunction between time, mm-hmm. especially in a story called Yellow Woman, when you feel you're in a place that is almost sacred or has hundreds of years of tradition behind it and history, and then you see the cars passing through and moving you and all the all of what amounts to modernity. I mean, it's kind of, in fact, you sort of talk about time and time travel in this book.
Yeah, it was, my journey was filled with instances of that kind of flickering between time. For example, I came to a spring in Santa Monica, on the border of Santa Monica, called Curavunga, which is one that had villages by it. And it's still flowing. It's still maintained, owned by the Gabrielino Tongva people. And now it's basically a well, but it's still bubbling up, and you can't drink the water anymore. There's a sign beside it that says non-potable because there are carcinogenic chemicals that are in it from the legacy of dry cleaning. And my journey was just full of instances like that where I thought about what was and what is now.
Well, in fact, I'm looking at a quote I took out of your book: "Time is the one true wilderness."
Yeah,
good, and that's a memorable quote.
I would stand by that. Part of the motivation for this book was to draw attention to the fact that wilderness is one of our constructs, and that when we hold up a wilderness, we are sort of neglecting the places where we actually live, or even sacrificing them. And so here was my attempt to draw our attention back to cities and suburbs.
Nick Neely is the author of Alta California, From San Diego to San Francisco, A Journey on foot to rediscover the Golden State. And indeed, all the issues that still face us are here in this journey or this saga of Nick's that he writes about, talking about water, gas and oil, immigration, development, but also a discovery of the beauty of the state, which a lot of people just don't see because they see mainly the freeways in the suburbs. And you've brought a kind of pictorial view of California that can be appreciated. And I'll even use a word that may seem to some to be a bit hyperbolic, cherished. I mean, there's a lot of beauty here, but there's also modernity and all that it brings with it. Managed to capture that division. I'd like to actually offer listeners an opportunity to tell us what they've seen in journeys through California. What parts of California have you visited that in your mind maybe exemplify the Golden State, for better or for worse? And here's a tweet from a listener, Tiven. It says, my body got sore just thinking about walking that far. Maybe I'd also ask listeners, if you've taken any of these journeys, any of these walks or hikes, and we talk about them with Michael Ellis from time to time, our own local great naturalist, what particularly strikes the chords in your memory and what particularly stays with you? We can join us now. Let me tell you how you can do that. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls, and please feel free to be part of the program. The number again, 866-733-6786, or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. Here's a tweet from Dean who says, I did something similar in 2011, only I ran between the missions, starting in Sonoma and ending in San Diego. It took me 12 days total, and it was an amazing experience.
Good for him.
Walking, I mean, seems tough enough to think of walking it, though, yeah. But running it, wow.
Yeah, you know, actually, I was only going about 8 to 10 miles a day because I was going exactly the expedition's pace and doing my very best to camp where they did night by night, which, sometimes meant, sleeping in the bushes in a dry creek bed. They were sending out a scouting party in advance of the movement of the main expedition, so they were moving slowly, and that, as from a writerly perspective, that was great because it allowed me more time to sort of poke around, follow my nose, and I had at the end of each day something more like museum legs than trekker's legs because I was really just lingering and loitering.
Museum's a good segue to bring Aaron Garcia in here, but I just want to, before I do that, ask you about some of the adventures you had. You were just about halfway there, and you were run over by a number of cars, stalked by a mountain lion. I mean, quite a lot of adventures here. When you talk about Nick's a big guy, 6'4", but all he had was a tent and Safeway card and a few other things like some clothes. When you got in Aventura, there were some problems. I mean, people didn't take you for a vagrant, but what happened in Aventura? You want to tell listeners?
Well, I walked in Ventura. I spent 3 days walking down the Santa Clara River Valley, camping mainly in the riverbed there. And I visited Satakoy, a neighborhood along the river that had a village, Chumash Village, that the Portola Expedition visited. And they served them something related to agave. Like a baked head of agave, which sounded quite delicious. But I had been walking through lemon groves for days in that valley, and I learned that there was a neighborhood nearby that had been the place where it was the first instance of farm workers buying their housing from growers. And I thought, in light of the groves, the orchards I'd walked through, I should go through there. And I was just completely out of place in that neighborhood, and I felt it. And then I was more or less escorted out of there by a really sweet individual named Ulysses, who, you know, I think he was on the lookout for me too, and he was protecting his neighborhood. And it was a good moment of recognition that, you know, I was an intruder in my way in the same way that the Spanish had been.
Could have been a lot worse, right? You were sweetly escorted out.
Yeah, you know, I didn't really feel threatened, but it was an interesting moment. I made the mistake of kind of growing out a beard along the way. I didn't think about it at the time, but it made me slightly less approachable, and people were wary of me. But I had a lot of great encounters.
It used to be a lot more difficult in the days when hippies were seen as aliens, but now beards are so much more acceptable. Let me bring a caller on here. Noelle, that's you. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, I'm really interested in what environments the author saw that would be most closely resemble the original environments the explorers would have seen. I'm an eighth generation Californian. My mom's family came in the 1781 expedition and ended up in Santa Barbara and then Los Angeles. And when I imagine them taking that journey, I'm always wondering, are there any places left where the ecosystem most closely resembles that of what they would have seen?
It's a good and important question, Nick.
Yeah, I'd say there are a lot of patches. There are a lot of swaths too that you, looking at them, you imagine they might look much as they did. Of course, European grasses, other invasives have swept through those areas and are hard to recognize from a distance or if you don't know your botany. And you look one way and you imagine you're seeing days of old, and you turn the other way and you see tract housing. And that, for instance, was really driven home for me in Irvine, where I camped at a spring known as Bertola Springs or Tomato Springs, and it was actually about to be engulfed by new housing, and behind it were old cattle grazing hills, and in the other direction was Irvine to the horizon. Just nothing but housing and lights, and I camped there out in the open, and in the morning a California gnatcatcher popped up through a sagebrush right there where I was camping, and that bird is being displaced and is a threatened bird because of development. But there it was, right on the edge. There's so much open space that's been maintained, but we've swallowed up a lot of it too.
Again, we're talking to Nick Neely, author of Alta California, From San Diego to San Francisco, A Journey on Foot to Rediscover the Golden State. Let's go to another caller, and that's you. Luke, you're on the air. Good morning.
Happy morning. What a fantastic show.
Love the California wildlife and nature. So I'm calling from Los Osos, which is central coast by Morrill Rock. And the beaches and cliffs of the Montana de Oro are an absolute not to be missed, with the Morrill Rock in the background. But then another trail is the Point Bouchon Trail, which ends up overlooking that apocalypse of Diablo Canyon. Mm. And so you have all of that natural amazingness with a potential apocalypse.
I like that word, amazingness.
Yeah, it's all entwined, and that's what I really wanted to show in this book. Interestingly, Point Bouchon is named after a chief that the expedition encountered, and he had what was described as a giant goiter on his neck and was revered up and down the coast. And in Los Osos Valley, the expedition encountered a troop of grizzlies, seven grizzlies, walking down that valley from San Luis Obispo, what's now San Luis Obispo. And they shot at them. One of the grizzlies apparently charged them and took down a mule, but the rider escaped. That was one of their more exciting episodes, I would say.
Let me thank the caller, and good to hear from you. We're going to have more calls in just a moment, but I want to say that really the expedition we're talking about here, the Portola expedition, sort of set the stage for not only the missions, as we said earlier, but also for forts and many other things. It's a kind of seminal California moment, really, isn't it?
I would completely agree. In the book, I argue that this laid the blueprint upon which the capital that came with the gold rush really sort of filled in that blueprint and built on top of it. But, some of the major developments that we see in Southern California really do conform to the early Mexican ranchos that are derived from the early mission lands. And in its way, portions of land have been atomized. But it's all there on top of those original names.
And again, our guest is Nick Neely. His book is called Alta California. And let me bring another caller aboard. Terry, welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me. I was wondering, what kind of shoes were you wearing? I can take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, thanks for that question.
I was wearing my trusty running shoes. I'm a former endurance runner, which in part gave me the confidence to do this trek, and I believe in lightweight shoes. So I wore my Asics running shoes, and I swapped them out once, and I think that was the right approach for me. My feet would get terribly sore at the end of each day, but miraculously each morning they felt better.
What about the rest of your anatomy? I mean, this is a lot of walking.
It was a lot of walking, and your body adjusts, gets used to the pace, and I tried, you know, the main thing is get enough water. I had one moment where I thought maybe I fractured a bone in my foot. I had done some kind of aggressive bouldering up a creek in the Santa Lucia Mountains, retracing their ascent of that range. And it turns out I think I'd only dislocated my cuboid bone, which I've done previously, and it popped back into place. But that was one moment where I wondered whether I might not finish the hike.
Well, I mentioned Erin Garcia a few moments ago. She's director of exhibitions at the California Historical Society. I want to bring her into this conversation. Erin, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm wondering about your thoughts about, I've got a couple minutes to the break, but just generally about this Portola expedition, because it really is central in California's history.
That's right. I think what Nick said about the Spanish sort of laying the blueprint in California for everything that happens after is really interesting. I actually was thinking about the way that the Yerba Buena Cove was originally, you know, the village of San Francisco. What became the San Francisco was really a village at Yerba Buena Cove, and the way that the Spanish sort of set up the grid from there, from what was... They laid the grid according to the laws of the Indies. That was the way that they set up cities on a kind of northwest north-south axis, and so that's where we get our modern day city kind of grows from that cove. And of course, the blocks that we know today as the financial district are really filled in from starting from that cove. And so mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting to think about. The changes that we see now to the original blueprint that the Spanish laid, and we have a picture in our current exhibition by Victor Prevost from 1847 that shows Yerba Buena Cove. And we just had a visitor in the other day asking, "Well, where is this? I can't see this. Where is this in San Francisco?" And that's because it's First Street now. It's completely covered by what were water lots. 100 years ago, 150 yeah. years ago.
Well, I know you've been thinking a lot about what was as opposed to what is, and we'll hear some more of your observations. I also want to hear from more listeners, particularly if you have some thoughts you'd like to share about things you've seen through walking in, well, any part of this great state that we live in here, this Golden State, or questions certainly about the history and about the natural beauty as well as just the natural things that have grown here and the animal life here. I mean, we're covering a lot of territory because Nick covers a lot of territory, literally and figuratively. Also interested in hearing some thoughts about Native Americans and their role here because, again, you're really talking about really 300,000 Native people who were living right there where we're talking about the center of things for California Alta. And Alta California is essentially the subject here. So feel free to join the program. We'll talk more. You can join us at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org. We're on Facebook and Twitter. We're at KQED Forum, and you can email your questions to forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest here in studio is Nick Neely, and Nick Neely is the author of Alta California, From San Diego to San Francisco, A Journey on Foot to Rediscover the Golden State. We also spoke with Erin Garcia before the break, director of exhibitions at the California Historical Society. And here's a question from Joe who wants to know, this is the sort of thing probably you do at the end of a program, but I'll ask you Joe's question now. He says, 2 years ago, I was wandering through Utah and came across the old Spanish Trail, which joined the Santa Fe, New Mexico area to Los Angeles. Is this next? Well, I guess when I say that would be maybe the last question before I say goodbye to you at the end of the hour. You thinking of doing more walks of this sort?
Not immediately. I've got hopefully a lot of career ahead of me, so it's not out of the question. I have entertained doing a kind of sequel of the from San Francisco north to the Oregon border, something maybe called the Lost Coast. But I don't think I'd want to do it walking. I think I'd want to maybe hop in a VW van and do it with my family, or much different kind of book.
Well, we were thinking of, and we may do a program on this in the future, having someone from the Redwood Trail. I mean, you could spend a lot of time on a lot of these early expeditions and trails do a number of programs, maybe in a whole series. I'm thinking out loud here. But here's Robert who wants to know, regarding the Spanish journals that Neely used, were they published in English or did he have to read them in the original Spanish script?
I'm not fluent in Spanish, and so I relied on the definitive translation, which is done by Professor Alan K. Brown and published by San Diego State University Press, and it's quite the tome. Yeah, there was no way I was going to carry that thing.
This is Julia Crespi. You were talking about mainly who?
Yeah, Juan Crespi.
Excuse me. Who was a padre?
Yeah, and he was asked specifically by the visitor general to record the good, the bad, and the indifferent, and he really took that to heart. And was criticized by Junipero Serra, for example, for going on far too long. And hopefully, if you read the book, you won't feel that I did the same thing. But it's, you know, reading the journal, most people would find it unremarkable. There's some exciting details in it, but he is really focused on counting the number of people and where they are, counting souls so that they could plop down missions, and also tracking water and soil quality.
I'm going to ask you a controversial question, and you mm-hmm. can take the fifth if you want, but since you mentioned Junipero Serra, there's still ongoing controversy. You've sort of immersed yourself into the history. You take a position on that?
I would err on the side of supporting and remembering the plight of California's indigenous people. And he was a man of his time. That's very true. And he believed in his cause wholeheartedly. But he did things like, you know, he sent soldiers out from Mission Carmel to bring back neophytes, natives who had wanted to leave the mission, and that is, by definition, you know, kind of slavery to return people, and
it's also kidnapping.
Yeah. So I think it is controversial, and I don't think the book comes down. It doesn't have a definitive stance on it, but
you're a naturalist. You're not a political writer, but you do deal with a lot of history here, and you do show us the devastating nature of indigenous people and what they had to suffer. Let me get some more callers on here. Bart is next. Bart, join us.
Hey, fascinating topic. Nick, I'm a Catholic priest. I hesitate to follow that last comment, actually. But I made the Camino de Santiago in 2015 I walked 600 miles from Lourdes to Santiago. Wow. And I've been very interested in the mission since I moved to California 35 years ago. Have visited all of them numerous times, but would really like to walk, would love to walk from San Diego to Sonoma, visiting each of the missions. It doesn't sound like you went to all of them. Maybe you did, but how possible would it be today to actually plot out a course and walk from mission to mission, and how long do you think it would take?
And we should mention there are, 21 of them, Nick?
Yeah. There are a number of people that do it, and there's a community out there. I think I learned recently there's a Facebook group called California Mission Walkers with over 1,000 members. Those are people who've either done, bridged a couple missions on foot, or some people have done all of them. California in general isn't especially walker friendly, so there's not an actual trail between the missions, but you can do it, and if your resolve is such, you'll have no problem.
Good luck to you, Bart, and thank you for the call. And let me go to a tweet here from Chris, who says, wants to know if you paid a visit to the Portola statue in Pacifica, and did you hike through there or camp in that area?
I absolutely did. I went through Pacifica. Pacifica is where they came over the Santa Cruz Mountains. So I arrived in Pacifica on November 4th. They actually were there a couple days earlier and camped. I was a little behind schedule at that point late in my journey.
But didn't you leave on the day they left?
I did. I left on July 14th. I flew into the San Diego airport on the day they left San Diego. And I arrived at the top of Sweeney Ridge on November 4th, which is when the whole expedition went over the top and saw the bay together. And then I walked 2 days south to Palo Alto, where they camped on between November 6th and 10th. And this year is the 250th anniversary. So there, you know, the ghost of the expedition, if you want to think about that, is currently in Pacifica right now, or heading just south, going back towards San Diego.
We may, speaking of ghosts, talk a little bit more in this hour about the ghost of John Steinbeck, but I want to read a question from a listener named James, who says, having lived near and hiked the trails of Portola Valley, I always assumed that the historical marker designated Old Spanish Trail was related to the Portola expedition, Alameda de las Pulgas, ostensibly named by the explorers, and the name Palo Alto are from Portola's expedition. Is that correct?
I'm not sure. Alameda de las Pulgas it's not in the journals. I'm not sure on that. They did arrive. Allegedly, they camped under El Palo Alto, and the book ends up there. And I write about the tree, which is still living. Whether it's the same redwood tree that they camped under or nearby is a difficult question and maybe impossible to answer. But yeah, remarkable that they ended up there in what's now the heart of Silicon Valley. One thing of interest to me personally was, did they walk through Portola Valley itself? And I came through Woodside and then looked at Jasper Ridge and thought, no, they probably didn't. They just hit the San Francisco Creek there and headed for the bay.
You're talking about walking through California and running through California. Here's a listener, Dave, who says some of my most memorable California journeys have been river trips as a whitewater kayaker. Many of these canyons are remote and largely unseen by the general public. The feeling for me when running these rivers is awe of the beauty, the remote beauty, and of the effort that humans went to in order to harness the water's power. Mining and railroad scars are still visible. And let's hear from some more of our callers. Let me go next to you, Gary. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. When I was a kid, you mentioned about the learning when you were a kid about Portola, and it reminded me of a trip my parents took me on. We went to all the missions. I was just probably about 8 years old or so. We took a trip to see every single mission when I was a kid, and that was a lot of fun. So I have this connection, I guess, to that learning through seeing and doing. But also when I was a Cub Scout, my mom took me down to this historic campsite on the banks of San Mateo Creek. And I always thought it was Portola. But actually, since I was listening to you here on the radio, I decided to drive here to the same spot. And I'm standing in front of the historic campsite. And it's actually De Anza, camped here in 1776. So I was a little bit wrong there, but
good for you. I'm glad that you went right to the marker.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful spot. It's absolutely beautiful. All these oak trees and this gorgeous creek here, and in right near downtown San Mateo. But also, isn't there a marker up near 280? In Millbrae, is that a Portola camp spot? Or
it is. That's their first campsite in the San Andreas Valley, which 280 runs through. And there is a sign there that says Portola Camp that many people in the Bay Area have probably passed and wondered about. That campsite is now underwater under the San Andreas Lake Reservoir, which is a City of San Francisco reservoir. And then their second camp, traveling south down the valley towards Palo Alto, is under Crystal Springs, one of the Crystal Springs reservoirs. So those are no longer, they don't see daylight. And in high school, actually, I had run along what's called the Sawyer Camp Trail, which is along those reservoirs. And I had never once thought about how the Portola Expedition had gone down, essentially walked that trail right over the San Andreas Fault. And in writing the book, it just made me think about how oblivious I was as a kid here in the Bay Area.
What was the most breathtaking or spectacular vista or sight that you saw on this trip?
It's so hard to say. Yeah. You know, the California coast is so spectacular that to pick a spot on it is difficult. But maybe the most unique was from the top of the Santa Lucia Mountains above Fort Hunter Liggett. And looking out, you know, the interesting thing about military bases is that those are some of the areas that are best preserved, even though their exercise is done in there. They have been pretty much left alone in ways that other areas haven't.
Here's Richard, who says, in rereading your book, I found all your encounters with nature and history fascinating, but those with our modern world somewhat depressing. Did you end up with a sense that we are stealing from nature and natives and replacing it and them with something far less appealing?
I mean, my journey was filled in part with a sense of loss. We really have degraded the landscape here and there. Many of the places where they camped are now remarkably changed. They're flooded, as is the case of San Andreas Lake, or concretized, or paved over, or dried out. I came to a lake that was described as beautiful and full of water, and it had been turned into a field of lettuce with groundwater pumping. There was no actual water in the lake anymore. But you can't walk the length of California without just being continuously awed, not only by the landscape, but by the impressive built environment and all the wonderful aspects of it. I mean, yeah, there are strip malls, but there's also remarkable resources that we've created, and the infrastructure to travel it quickly and enjoy it.
And again, Nick Neely with us, author of Alta California, From San Diego to San Francisco, A Journey on Foot to Rediscover the Golden State. Let me thank the caller, and let me bring Louis Busby into this conversation, author of Steinbeck's Ghost. I said earlier we were talking about ghosts, and Louis is on part-time faculty at University of San Francisco. Good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
Well, let me begin by asking you what your California place is and how the history there brought you to that place. We're talking about Salinas, aren't we?
Well, certainly. I grew up in San Jose. I'm a fourth-generation California immigrant. My great-grandmother was born in Oakland. I grew up in San Jose, where there were cherry orchards at the end of my street until it was seven, and then they became more tract houses. And so I was just growing up where I grew up. And then, like many of us, it was through John Steinbeck's work that I really began to see and understand California. When I was 15, I had to do a book report on the Grapes of Wrath. And then within a year, I had read everything Steinbeck had ever written. And then when I turned 16, at the end of that year, I got a car. And I started driving down into Steinbeck country, which we had gone through before, but I was on my own now. And so I was at the Steinbeck house in Salinas. I was at Doc Ricketts' lab on Cannery Row, before the aquarium was there. That's still there, Doc Ricketts' lab. And then just driving around through the country. And what literature can do and what Steinbeck did for me was make me see and understand the place in a way that I had never done before. To understand really the history of it in a very deep way, as well as the beauty of it. You've been talking about time travel here, and I think to go to Steinbeck places now, to his house in Salinas, to Cannery Row, to see that old laboratory, and then just driving around, just to go through all of the history. You stop at Mission San Juan Bautista on the way. You can read and see the mission there. It's one of the best-kept missions. You can meet with members of the Amamutsun tribal band who are still active and part of the interpreting there. And then you can drive out Corral de Tierra Road, which is just off of 68 between Salinas and Monterey, and just keep driving to the end of it. And there you get this vista of what California looked like at some point.
Well, you also raise what I think of as a fascinating question, Louis, and we should say, by the way, I know that area from Esalen Institute, which you think about the Esalen Indians, and actually Michael Murphy, who was the founder of Esalen Institute, his father was John Steinbeck's family doctor. But you go back to 1902 when Steinbeck was sort of brought into the world, so to speak, maybe by Michael Murphy's father, I don't know. But the reality is that the landscape is so different and yet in many ways not so different. Can you really learn about Salinas, and can you learn about that world that Steinbeck brings alive, not so much in The Grapes of Wrath, but in most of his other work, through literature? That's always been a fascinating question to me. Learn about what it was like, in other words, when Steinbeck was a kid growing up like you described.
And so when Steinbeck's a kid, he's born in 1902, and when he's a child, he's living in a country that has just been 50 years earlier taken over by the Americans, right? The non-Spanish Europeans who've come in. So the place is still pretty wide open, and his family had been there for a while. And so if you go through all of Steinbeck's California work, the Long Valley in particular, Pastures of Heaven as well, and even Cup of Gold, his first pirate book, Into a God Unknown. If you start to go through those, you see threads where Steinbeck is constantly referring to first there were the first tribes, and then came the Spanish, and now the Americans. And he follows the degradation of the landscape. And to a large degree, that's what East of Eden is about. He begins East of Eden with this beautiful prose poem to the beauty of nature in California. It ends with the arrival of all the people who came here. And then the entire novel ends with World War I crashing in on California and the complete transformation of the Salinas Valley into an industrial, agricultural world.
And it was beautiful, but so we should add, just as a foot, it wasn't really pastoral or bucolic. It was a different kind of aesthetic. Yeah.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I also think, you know, so, when you talk about this area and you talk about Steinbeck, you think about, well, the Dark Watchers and all that kind of stuff as well. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. we can talk about the beauty, but and wasn't Steinbeck actually kind of ushered out by farmers?
No, he was chased out of Salinas.
Right, trying to be nice about
it. By the FBI and by local farmers. When I first went to the Steinbeck house, where you can have a wonderful lunch, and it's a great
actually,
tour.
I did have lunch there on my trek. It didn't make it into the book, but it was a special experience I would recommend.
Special because?
Just, you know, imagining him as a kid running through those rooms and then having a nice salad is a unique California experience.
Well, Lewis mentioned Doc Ricketts. I mean, you can't go down there and not think of all that oceanic stuff, too.
Yeah, and I walked past the lab, too, in Cannery Row when I made my foray over there.
Now, Lewis,
I'd like to add that the Doc's lab on Cannery Row is now open to the public, and about once a month they take you on tours through them. I really recommend that to anyone.
And again, Lewis Busby is the author of Steinbeck's Ghost and teaches at the University of San Francisco. Good to have you with us, Lewis. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having it.
And we're going to continue with Nick Neely and your calls, and remind you, you can join us here live at 866-733-6786, or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. Harry says, how did the author use the journals to find the trail? Very little of the original terrain described in the journals remains. I have been to a few places on the Central Coast, and most of the locations have been paved over.
It's true. The translation that I use conveniently identifies, in concert with other historians, I think, the places where they camped night by night. Even in downtown Los Angeles, they walked right through what's now Los Angeles and actually gave name to the river. In downtown Los Angeles, you know, this translation points you to an intersection that, and you go there, and there's a memorial. So to some extent, I was relying on that. But you reading the journals, you can also see based on the distances and the water. They were always in search of water. For the most part, I agreed with what had been pointed to as their camps.
Another caller, Pat, joins us from Oakland. Pat, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. When I was very young, about 8 or 10 in 1953, my grandmother, who was from Santa Ana, took me to the Boy Scout Jamboree, which was 53,000 Boy Scouts who came to Irvine and camped out there and did all sorts of things, the kind of things you get for your badges and all those wonderful things. And so what is now the Irvine, University of Irvine, was once this just totally open area of hills, Golden Hills, and at one period, these Boy Scouts coming from far away. It was the first time they had gathered on the West Coast. Getting there, you pass through just all kinds of orange groves and the scent of oranges. It was a different place. Very, very, very beautiful.
Very nicely described, Pat, and thank you for that. I find myself, when I go to Silicon Valley, Nick, thinking about what it was like before. I mean, you know, you go to Sand Hill Road and you wind up there, in fact, and you think about what it used to be with all the orchards and all the beauty and so forth. Here's a listener who writes, just a reminder that the landscape was not wild. Indigenous peoples had millennia of intimate study of their place and resources and fine-tuning of lifeways and practices. California was well and thoroughly cultivated.
Yeah, absolutely. They, you know, they especially use fire as a way to tend the landscape. They were interested in cultivating annual forbs and grasses, and so they would set fires regularly. In fact, the Bertolla expedition describes consistently walking through areas that were completely burnt over, you know, for a whole day's walk, and that was the native populations encouraging their grasses, which they harvested seeds from, and they actually served those seeds as mush to the Bertolla expedition.
Another caller, Evan, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Wonderful show. I have bicycled much of the state starting in 1969. And for those who are interested in the subject, I highly recommend a book called California Coast Trails by J. Smeaton Chase. It's a horseback adventure from Mexico to Oregon in 1911. Chase was a Scotsman who came to California early and in his life and fell in love with the state. And with the popularity of automobiles around the turn of the century, he just decided to see it before it was all lost. And he has a wonderful chronicle of his ride from the Mexican border up to Oregon on his trusted horse, and has just quite a sense for the nature and the history of the state, a great companion, a great read for those who are interested in the subject.
Some days on my walk, I wished I had a horse, but that would have been a very different experience taking my horse through downtown L.A.
Of course, Bertolla had horses and mules, right?
That's right. Yeah, 50 mules and as many horses. And, you know, they were constantly concerned with making sure they found water for them. And they would send the scouts on. You know, sometimes the scouts would go a couple days distance in advance, and they'd bring multiple horses so that they could change mounts mid-excursion.
They also had a lot of flour and liquor.
Yeah, they had all the mules were carrying chests of supplies. They brought chocolate as a drink for the officers, and they also brought chests of beads to give out to the villages as they passed through.
Here's Tanya. Tanya, join us. You're on forum.
Yes, hi. I wanted to reflect how the environment here really shapes who we are. I came here in the early 90s from Eastern Europe and then got a chance to live on the East Coast of the United States, where it's much harder to get out, like get away. And so, I don't know, it's like the sense of we can get away from it all, and we do, and we go into ourselves more. Maybe it's like it feels very West Coast. And so, you know, maybe it's not all over like this. We definitely have like our overdeveloped built spaces, but it's like something very Californian. We want to get out into the nature.
Nicely said. And Nick is nodding his head with that. Thank you for the call. Let me get another caller. Actually, let me go back to something that was said before with you for a minute, Nick. I mean, this expedition is coming on two and a half centuries. I mean, What do we learn from this? I mean, particularly in terms of what may apply and be necessary, in your judgment, for our own modern circumstances?
That's a tough question. I think they were exploring fairly carefully, and they had to do that. Because they want, you know, they didn't want to be overrun by the natives. They were being extraordinarily friendly. They had no violent encounters on this first expedition to San Francisco and back. And I guess, you know, maybe I could say that we, you know, moving forward as a state, as a people, we need to sort of have the same philosophy. You know, it's kind of abiding caution and just sort of a curiosity, but a hesitancy to act.
So why do you live in Idaho now?
You know, it's a little bit happenstance. My family, I had grown up going there as a kid, and it seemed like a great place for a writer and an artist to be for a time.
You're on Sun Valley?
Yeah. We're in the Wood River Valley, yeah, yeah. Down the valley from Ketchum. And my wife is a realist oil painter, and so we were looking for an outdoorsy place that was kind of out of the way, and that fit the bill. And who knows how long we'll be there.
It was beautiful,
yeah.
There's much to recommend it. Again, we're talking to Nick Neely. He's the author of Alta California, From San Diego to San Francisco, A Journey on Foot to Rediscover the Golden State. And here's a listener who writes, I hiked 1,000 miles of the California Coastal Trail from Malibu to Southern Oregon. I want to write about it. The author has inspired me to go back to my journals and write more thoughtfully about my trip. So you're inspiring another writer.
That's wonderful. I hope you do that.
It's a good feeling, isn't it? And maybe we have time for maybe one more caller. Let's give it a shot quickly, Dennis. If you could be fast, please. Dennis, are you there?
Yes, I am. Let me turn down the radio here.
Okay.
I thought I could call in because I was asked by the National Park Service to do the artwork for the wayside images for the Portola, the 250th anniversary of the Portola expedition. And so I think they'll appear there on Sweeney Ridge and other places. But I thought I would call in and tell you that.
See them.
Nick's getting excited, and you've now given people the recognition that they're going to be out there. Thank you for that, Dennis. It's a good place to end here because we have to end here. Nick, good to have you aboard. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Michael.
My pleasure. Nick Neely's book is Alta California, From San Diego to San Francisco, A Journey on Foot to Rediscover the Golden State. And again, we're here with you Monday through Friday from 9 to 11. You can continue this online, kqed.org/forum. Have a good weekend. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.